This is Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. This is Brian Diaz. I am your host. Happy to be here with you today on a Thanksgiving holiday weekend. If you're listening to the podcast, presumably you are hearing this after Thanksgiving. So I hope that everybody had a really nice holiday and had a great time with loved ones. That's what it's all about. And actually, this is a little bit different here today, what we're doing. If you listen to the show on the radio on Thanksgiving on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, where I am, basically, we wanted to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to be with their loved ones that works at the station. So everybody runs reruns of previous shows. So that's what we did. We ran a show from the recent past here out at the Runaway Boucherie in Lafayette, or just north of Lafayette in Cajun Country in Louisiana. Very fascinating show. So it's available on the podcast from a couple weeks ago, actually. So if you want to go check that out, that's great. That's there. And that was what was aired on the radio. Here on the podcast, what I decided to do to keep something a little bit different is... not going to do anything new other than here in the opening segment, but basically what I did is I've culled together some interviews from three different shows that I think are more of our thought-provoking conversations. Now, of course, this is a drink and food show, as you know, so I don't want to make anybody work too hard at anything. But, you know, there's a lot of important issues connected to the food and beverage industry and things like that that we have going on everywhere, really, in New Orleans in particular is what we focus on, as you know. But a lot of these things are applicable elsewhere. The first interview that we have is with three talented women bartenders, Adrian Miller of Bartonique and Toops Meadery, Sam Perry of Canaan Table. Actually, had the good fortune of spending some time with Sam last evening, Wednesday, Thanksgiving Eve. She is moving to Chicago, so good luck to her there. Went to her last shift at Canaan Table. She's going to take Chicago by storm. And then also Katie Dubois, my good friend over there at Barrel Proof in the Lower Garden District. And what we talked about with those three is our gender issues behind the bar. And it was a fascinating conversation, very spirited conversation. These three women professionals are very thoughtful, have a lot to say on the issue, very talented bartenders. And so that's a nice little three-segment run there. And then from there, we interview Toby Rodriguez. That's actually an interview that I pulled from the Runaway Boucherie show that I was just talking about in Cajun Country. Toby was in charge of the boucherie, or it's a French word and Cajun word for butchering. He was the head butcher there, and that's what that event was all about, was connecting with food. And we talk a little bit about Boucherie and the event with Toby. Very fascinating conversation. I do encourage you, if you haven't heard it, to go listen to the whole show, because we talked to attendees as well as some of the other organizers and different folks that were involved with the event. Very, very fascinating. That's on our website too, noladrinks.com. And then the last interview, two friends, Nick Dietrich, who is one of the proprietors of the aforementioned Canaan Table, also Cure, which is sort of the original new wave craft cocktail bar in the uptown area of New Orleans, and then also the newly opened Cafe Henri in the Bywater neighborhood, and along with Braden Legrone, who similarly is just about to leave New Orleans, moving to Mexico. And that's what we talked about. We were talking about agave production, more specifically, or I should say maybe even more generally, talking about mezcal. It's the traditional way of life, a traditional process, and there's a lot of threats threatening traditional mezcal production, the mezcaleros, the people who make it their way of life. And these two gentlemen, Nick Dietrich and Braden Legrone, are both very knowledgeable and passionate about agave, and we have an interesting conversation about how mezcal is made. Tequila is essentially a subset of mezcal. It's an agave product made specifically from the blue agave. In the case of mezcal, there are probably 40, maybe 50, there's a whole lot more than that, but 40 or 50 typically used species of agave used to make mezcal and other similar beverages. So we talk about that. We talk about the traditional approaches, way of life, and some of the threats to agave production in Mexico. And that's where Braden is heading. He's moving right down into the heart of the agave world there on the central west coast of Mexico to take over a bar and follow his passion for agave. So it all seemed kind of fitting. Some people leaving New Orleans, a couple good friends on new journeys, which is always fascinating. And I can't wait to get reports from them as they come back for a visit, or let us know how things are going from afar. And yeah, again, a little bit of a thought-provoking stuff, hopefully, here on the NOLA Drinks Show. I hope you enjoy it. We'll be back next Thursday for an interesting show. The one thing I know we have going on is we're going to talk a little bit about champagne and bubbly for the holidays. That's going to be a lot of fun, believe me. Get ready to pop some bottles and have some bubbles. So hope you enjoy the show, folks. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and look forward to checking in with you next week. Come on back. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition, WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. This is Brian Diaz. I am your host. I am happy to have you here today. I am happy to have a full studio of guests, good friends of mine that are here. Adrian Miller from Bartonique and other stuff.
The new bar manager of the new and up-and-coming Toops South and the Toops Meadery, and this is the first time anybody knows about it.
Why I didn't say it, because I didn't know if that was so that's cool. The cat is out of the bag, as they say. Katie Dubois from Barrel Proof. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
You survived whiskey camp.
I did. I do have a little camp flu, so I sound a little hoarse, but I survived.
That's okay. And you brought whiskey with you, so you're making friends fast.
You have to. Whiskey's an easy way to do it.
Absolutely. Especially in this crowd. And I mean, that's like the Anthony over here who works the board. That is Anthony's favorite thing in the whole wide. He's saying thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so you've made a friend here today, Katie, whether you want to or not. And then Sam Perry from Cane & Table. Hi, Sam.
Hey.
How you doing?
Very well.
Excellent.
For having me.
Yeah, great. Thank. Always a pleasure. And you were on a couple weeks ago. Is that right? When we were talking about rum from Martinique and
Just about like 2-3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago. Yeah, something like that. Actually, you know what? I forgot that was the very first version of the NOLA Drinks edition of this show. You were my very first guest.
Yeah, and you did awesome.
Oh, hey, geez, thanks. I don't know about that. I mean, haven't gotten canceled yet, so that part's good.
Nah, you're good.
Thank you. Well, hey, you guys we're out there listening, what we got going on here today, I mentioned at the top of the show, we do a segment called What's in Your Glass, What's in Your Bottle, and we like to tackle issues as it relates to the drink and food world, sometimes social, sometimes cultural, economic, political, environmental, these sorts of things. And in this particular case today, sort of a hot button issue in the service industry for a long time, really, this isn't anything new, as I said earlier, but kind of ramped up, maybe is the way to say, the dialogue about gender issues behind the bar. And all three of these very talented professional women have a lot of insight into this. And at one point or another, all three of you have expressed something to me, just like when we're all hanging out in different places. And that really means that I'm sitting at your bar, which I do a lot with all three of you. So, that's not a surprise, really. This has sort of come up as a topic in some fashion or another. And you guys have all expressed some amount a good amount of passion and in interest in this and wanting to express something. So that's why I thought all three of you were ideal to be here today. I didn't necessarily have a particular agenda. I figured the conversation would just flow. But the one thing, I was reading an article actually from Rosewater Magazine, which is, I believe, an online publication. It was actually from about a year ago. Natalie Bree is the author of the article, and she's was a longtime bartender, is a longtime bartender in Chicago. And she was railing on a lot of stuff, and rightfully so, what she was talking about. But one of the things that she says in her piece is, from my experience, male bartenders are more commonly admired for their work and passion for their craft, while female bartenders are more often stereotyped and pegged as, quote, damaged. A customer once said to me, quote, you aren't the type of girl who I'd expect to be a bartender. You seem smart. You don't seem like you're just bartending because you have daddy issues or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Loaded.
And it's not surprising.
And Sam, elaborate, please. I mean, it's not, is it? I mean,
oh no, it's not. I mean, I've gotten comments like that before, and I'm sure y'all have as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hate to be presumptuous, but yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially in like a very whiskey driven bar, tendency already to be a very masculine sort of arena. Mm-hmm. So it also for guests might seem a little bit more extreme than someone as myself would be the one behind the stick.
Yeah, right. And Katie, you know, you said, I remember you said something, and I think you said this on Facebook even, but we talked about it a little bit after the fact, that during Tales of the Cocktail in July, I was going to say maybe people that should know better attending Tales, but of course that's really not the case, because a lot of that turns into a frat party. And, you know, we get the bro thing going on and all that. You had some pretty rude stuff said to you.
Yeah, I got catcalled on the streets of the French Quarter the very first night of Tales, and the group of gentlemen were all wearing Tales of the Cocktail wristbands.
So we know.
I thought it was a very strange sort of almost like reverse psychology there, where they would be able to respect me behind the bar of my establishment, but walking down the street of the French Quarter, I was just as much sort of free reign for them as any other woman who would be walking down the street.
Mm-hmm. And again, totally unacceptable.
Completely unacceptable.
And Adrian, you're over there at Tonique, and Tonique, I know, it can turn into a kind of a wild place later at night. We have this joke. I mean, you know, I say this to you all the time. I've been in bartending probably 150 times in my life and maybe 3 times after 8 o'clock. So these are only things that I hear that go on at 10 or 11 o'clock. But,
at Tonic, it's a different story, especially if I'm behind the bar. A lot of people come in and they see I have a very stern face, whether it's me, I'm always in thought. So I never really look at myself. As people call it, a resting B face. You know, I have that a lot. And I'm really like, I'm really not an a-hole. I'm just in thought or doing something. But a lot of people, you know, they try to get smart with me. And I'm like, I'm shutting this down real quick. Mm-hmm. There's another bartender there. And she's really polite. She's really sweet. She's actually one of the best bartenders I've ever mm-hmm. seen behind the bar. Little Jessie.
Jessie, sure.
Jessie's a beast. Yeah. I love her. But a lot of people... She's a lot softer than I am, and I will rip anybody a new one who messes with her. And a lot of people tend to mess with her more than they would with me. And I think it's...
Now, because of her physical stature, she's
pretty
short?
Much. And, yeah, I really honestly feel that way. And it makes me kind of disgusted and sad. Like, why would you pick on somebody just because they're smaller and more petite, and you see me, and I'm a big, brunt woman. I have a lot of masculine features. I think my thing behind the bar is either like if I were to see Katie or Sam behind the bar, I would, even as a customer, I'd be like, I think you know how to do something. You know, I feel like a lot of people automatically assume because we're women, we don't know much. And that's the thing that really makes me angry is stepping into this whole entire thing that's kind of been swept under the rug in a way, and now it's getting more and more shed to light because we've all had to deal with this. It really just blows my mind that still, as in 2006, Katie's getting catcalled. Sam is getting people are making assumptions that, oh, you can bartend? That's, wow, congratulations. Right. It's like a pat on the back. Like, no, we've been in the do-dirt situations where we can do things and we are just as smart and better than men. Sorry, but it's true. I'm sorry. Like a lot of female bartenders that I know can run circles around dudes. You saw at Rematch, mm-hmm. Cassandra killed it. Oh, Ashley Danella and killed it.
And you guys, before
we for camp, yeah, cool. A girl one.
That's
wow. Okay, great. And explain what Rematch is so people know, just so they know.
I don't even know what Rematch was.
Okay, well, it was just
a speed competition. Yeah. And it was just honestly like one of the best things I've ever done, just to sit there and watch everybody do so well and be so poised and still kick so much amazing butt. But it just blows my mind that we're still talking about this. It's 2016. We're still talking about race and how it's not okay to be a black person, how it's not okay to be a Mexican person, how it's not okay to be a person of color and all this white privilege and all these other things that are going on. It's not okay. And it just blows my mind still to this day that we're still having this conversation.
And Adrian, and you know, since we're on radio, so we got to describe things that people can't see. No. So, and you are a woman of color.
I am three of the bad things in life. I'm a Mexican, I am black, and I am a woman. And
I love all those things.
Yeah. All the terrible things that people are talking about right now. Yeah. But it's just, I'm really terrible at words right now. I'm not going to lie. I can't say how I feel because I'm so angry right now about the fact that I've worked so hard, and I know both of these women have worked so hard, and still we get this assumption that we are, you know, the girls that people hire behind bars to sit here and be like, ha! Yeah. I'm going to make you something with grenadine. No, I'm actually going to make you a cocktail that you can drink and that's palatable. And I've learned all these things. And we're not behind the bar. I'm sorry. We're not.
Yeah.
And a lot of women who are up and coming and doing this and battling this out are not those things.
Yeah. You know, and we talked about this, or I talk about this a lot on the show. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the show that, you know, this is a trade and this is a profession. And those of you who are doing this across the board, no matter who we're really talking about, in the establishments in which all three of you work, you're a pro. And you have earned your way there as a professional. I'm not saying every company is perfect. And we got about 2 minutes before we got to take a break. But Sam, I mean, how do you feel? You in your case, I think if I have the story right, you were working at a higher paying job tending bar, and you left that job to go do the apprentice program at Cane and Table to further your career as a professional bartender, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was at this place, I'm not going to name names. It's not open anymore. But I was there for about 2 years, fine dining, got paid an obscene amount of money, and I didn't learn anything because I was a female behind the bar, you know, and I essentially ran that bar. But my manager didn't show me the ropes and didn't show. I didn't understand that it was a possibility, right? I didn't want to bartend until I finally realized, like, oh wait, like there's upward mobility, right? There's something in this for me because it wasn't an opportunity for me. That's a little convoluted, but like,
so your intention wasn't to go down this career trajectory when you got into it. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Okay. And it's because I was kind of treated like a bar wench. Okay. I was a bartender, a head bartender that was basically a bar back to my manager who just wanted to show off to his friends and to the bartending community. Does any of that make any sense?
It does. It absolutely does.
That's, yeah.
Okay, y'all, what we're going to do... Yeah,
doing
right.
That.
Y'all, we got to take a quick break here on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here at our top of the hour break. Come on back. We're going to continue this conversation with Sam, Katie, and Adrian. Don't go away. All right, everybody. Welcome back to hour number two of the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. This is Brian Diaz. Happy to be here with you. WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. Thanks for tuning in today. Hey, we are talking a little bit about gender issues behind the bar, but we're going to take a very, very brief respite about that because this is a show about drinking, and we are doing that right now. I don't want people out there to think that we're, you know, on the wagon here just because we're talking about a serious issue. Quite the contrary. And Sam, you've brought in something very interesting that we're tasting right now.
Yeah, so it's called a Rancio Sec. It's a wine. The one that we're drinking in particular right now is called Matifo. It's House Alpens distributes it. So it's an oxidized wine. This one in particular is Grenache Noir. And so what they do, it's a very, very old tradition found in Catalonia. And a lot of families will do it. So it's not something that people do to make money. They make it for family, for friends, for guests, for like house guests and stuff. So what they do is they take the wine and they put it in these really large glass demijohns. Just think of like a really, really big, like glass jar with a really narrow, spout basically. And it cooks, it sits and cooks for years and years and years. Sometimes even 10 years, not for a minimum of 5 years. So the flavor is very nutty, kind of like salted meat, kind of similar profile wise to like a Fino sherry.
Mm-hmm. When I smelled it, actually, I first thought it was a sherry because that oxidative note's very, very prevalent on it. But it's more savory, I think, as you were saying, with the nutty notes and the meaty notes.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very savory. Almost like kind of like a little bit of saline in there.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
And so, you know, back to the topic at hand. One of the things actually that I wanted to mention, this goes back a number of years. I was sitting in Bar Tonique, and a mutual friend, I believe, of all of ours here, Basil Zarinski, who used to work at Bar Tonique and is now at Catahoula Hotel. Actually, now I think in Germany on vacation. Lucky person. But anyway, aside from that, is employed at Catahoula Hotel. Very fine bartender in her own right. And I just got to know Basil a little bit, and it was an afternoon, which is usually when I'm sitting in Tawny, and a couple came in, and they were here from out of town, and they said to her, I'm paraphrasing, but it was almost said this way, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And then last night, I was actually after the show. People are just going to think that's all I do is go to bars, and they'd be kind of halfway right, but I was actually sitting.
You're an adult. Do what you want.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you.
And, you're an adult.
Yeah, I was adulting last night in a bar, and I was over at Sylvain, another friend, I think, of most of ours, Jillian White, who is behind the bar at Sylvain and now going to be taking over the bar program at Mobar. That was the exact same thing she said to me when I was telling her what we were up to today. That question happens all the time. You don't hear males ask that. And I think there's a legitimate question or assumption, maybe, for lack of a better way to put it, that, you know, a lot of people work their way through school in the service industry. And that's what she was talking about, that, you know, but the assumption that that is why you're there almost certainly is the only reason why you could possibly be doing what you're doing is because you're maybe working your way through school.
I actually found that question to be more common when I worked in a restaurant bar than ever working at Barrel Proof, which is bar only. I actually don't really receive that question anymore. People assume that in that role, in that place, that this is my career move.
Okay.
Even our, like, worst clientele, I don't actually receive that question anymore.
Okay.
I don't know if there's some sort of connection. I don't know if there's some sort of connection between the idea of, like, I just work in restaurants until I make it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, that I hear that a lot, where it's this sort of thing where it's a transitional job. And I mean, you know, I waited tables right after I graduated from college because that's what I needed to do to pay rent. I didn't want to continue to, I was working at a Chili's, for God's sakes. Talk about a horrible thing.
They make the best margaritas.
I worked at Uno's. I feel you.
You worked at Pizzeria Uno?
Yeah, in Kenmore Square next to Fenway Park.
I bet that was a blast. And okay, IHOP.
The guy.
IHOP. All right. So we have all felt this kind of pain at some level or another. But anyway, you know, and that's why I was there. But I mean, again, you know, treating people with the assumption that that is the case, that you're only there for a transitional reason, especially in given your three positions and what you do, you know, where you work and what you're doing, this is a career. And so, I mean, do you, Sam, get that? I mean, have you had anybody ask you that kind of question where, like, you know, what are you going to do next in life? And just assume that this is a stepping stone thing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked quite a few times, like, oh, so, like, are you a career bartender? I have gotten that, definitely.
Okay. Do you think that's a bad question? Or do you think that's only going to come to you because you're female? Or do you think that that's... what's your take on that?
I'm a super, like, femmy person. I wear lipstick to work. I, like, do my hair up. I'm just one of those people. High femme. So I'm always being bombarded with questions like that. Like, you know, well, what else are you doing? Or can we talk to the bartender? Or, I mean, Have you? I figured that y'all.
That one's a big one.
You're like, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what they want.
To me
and,
before.
Yes.
And I'm like, I am she, the bartender. but yeah, I mean, I'm bombarded with questions like that all the time.
And Adrian, you?
No, people usually ask me other questions, like stupid things that I don't even want to say on air. But when I have been asked, when I have been asked, I'm like, no, this is what I want to do with my life. Like, I'm super passionate about what I do. And I think also, when people see that in you, like, as all three of us, I mean, I haven't seen you bartend. I've seen you bartend, like, twice, Sam. Mm-hmm. But, like, watching Katie behind the bar, you know that that girl's passionate. You see it in us. And you see that, honestly, I feel like people don't ask that question when they can see that in you. And people also make stupid assumptions about us. And that's another thing that, you know, we chose this. Some people fell into it, and then they're like, oh, I fell in love with this at this point in time. Or something happened in their life and they were just like, I came back to the restaurant industry because it just makes me happy. And, you know,
so, and that can happen to anybody in almost any career, right?
Exactly.
So, mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just, for me, it's waking up every day, even though right now I don't want to. Every day I'm ripping my hair out. But at the end of the day, I know it's going to be worth it. And, you know, I work at one of the best jobs I've ever had. I love Tanique with my heart and soul and have it tattooed to me for some odd reason. I was the only dummy that got that.
Lifer.
Yeah, I know. I am a lifer.
Yeah, if you ever want to know if I'm a lifer or not, just know that I'm branded on my body.
Also, barrel proof?
I have a Jim Beam tattoo.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. That's awesome. I don't mean to digress, but...
No, please.
In reference to what we were talking about before, I think... one of the questions, and Sam, you mentioned it, was people are like, oh, can I talk to the bartender?
Mm-hmm.
Even on days where I'm the only one behind the bar, which I always think is an interesting thing because it's a constant battle in that bar because it is very masculine. It is 270 plus whiskeys at any given time. And people have a hard time trusting me to be able to understand the product the way that a man may understand the product. So I think sometimes people don't necessarily even see me per se, or just see me as a woman behind this bar is a necessary evil to keep the balance.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to actually ask you two this question because when I'm at Toops giving whiskey flavor profiles, do you guys get the surprise look on your face when you're talking with a male about how much you know about whiskey and they're like, wow, you know a lot about things, or they actually start trusting you. I mean, I get that a lot.
My own friends do that. Just FYI. My own male friends. My counterpart.
I'm sorry, what?
Have the same response sometimes.
Hmm.
It's beyond just the clientele.
Wow.
It's, yeah.
And Sam, were you going to add something to that?
What was I going to say? I was going to say that, well, I work at a rum bar. So I was talking to Katie about this. She PM'd me on Facebook and, you know, we were just talking about like the trend, like it's more of a trend now. You'll see more women behind the bar and a lot of Barrel Proof is incredible. And I mean, the knowledge base you have to there is insane. And being a female, I mean, I can only imagine that men come in and are like blown away that you know way more than they do. Just, and there's this assumption that women don't have the palate for something that's really heated like a nice whiskey, right? But for me, I work in a rum bar, and it's funny because I mean there. The amount of men that drink whiskey, it's more so than, because it's such a masculine thing,
you
right?
Perceived that
drink,
way, sure. Yeah.
I want to drink bourbon. I want to drink a nice rye. Mm-hmm. And I want to neat. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, I can help you with that. I also have a lot of rum. And so, you know, they're blown away. I'm like, well, what do you normally drink? Okay, I can find a rum that'll match that. And they're blown away. Mm-hmm. They're like, this girl wearing lipstick with her hair done up, she looks like a 50s prom queen. Like, I figured she'd be an idiot. And I'm like, no. There's a reason why I work. I am the
Surprise,
bartender.
Surprise, I'm smart.
Yeah, wow.
I'm using my lady brain.
Yeah,
so.
Wow. Y'all, we're going to take another quick break here on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show. NOLA Drinks Edition. We're going to continue this conversation right when we come back. Short break. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Brian D is here with you today on a Thursday. Thanks for joining us. WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. So we are talking with Sam Perry, Katie Dubois, and Adrian Miller, and discussing really a whole host of topics and issues connected to gender issues behind the bar. What I wanted to ask you all was kind of, I think maybe a spring, I don't want to use this term, but I will, I guess, for expedience sake, a sort of a springboard to a lot of the conversation that sort of blew up in the service industry was a few months ago in the spring. There's a bar in New York called Employees Only. And, that is what it is. And they basically were accused, rightfully so, I think you guys can kind of please elaborate on this, but, for only hiring males. And really the issue was that they put out an ad. I said this at the top of the show. They put out an ad for they were opening a Singapore location. And the ad was basically, the implication was, we want to hire dudes for the bar and we want hot cocktail waitresses for the floor. And that was the implication. And that was kind of where all this came from. I think that's pretty commonplace. And what was your take on that when that happened, or that conversation? What were you all hearing, or was there backlash? I mean, you're grimacing. We're doing radio, so I'm describing this. Adrian's sitting over there grimacing.
I have a few. Well, I don't want to get into it too much, honestly. I'm going to take a back step on this because I have a lot to say about it. There was a point, because there was another side note to that whole entire thing. There was a group that I'm part of, and they went in super hard on those dudes. And I get it. They're also misogynists. I'm sorry. It's very true. And some of those dudes I actually really respect. And some of the people on this side note page that I was on kind of took it a little too far. And not only did those people take it a little too far, one of those people also did something in another term along the same lines that they did, and they didn't get the same backlash. And I was like,
"No." So, so we need to elaborate a little bit.
I'm very vague. Yeah, yeah.
What did the other person do then specifically? Was this a male that we're talking about?
No, it was a female.
Okay.
She did some kind of racist things on her own page, and I called her out about it And I said, you basically kind of did the same thing that the EO dudes did, and you did it in a very derogatory term to Mexican people, and it's not okay. You can't bitch about, oh, sorry. You can't yell about something and then do the same, something along the same lines.
So was this Adrian complaining about, I mean, like, was it saying something inappropriate about hiring Mexican people or something?
No,
or?
She put on a sombrero and had a mustache and
did the caricature
thing. Did the caricature thing. And I was just like, you can't have it both ways.
Right.
My whole take on that EO thing, though, was it is EO. I mean, I've been to that bar. I know some of those dudes. That's what they wanted. And honestly, like, I don't know. Somebody else take the floor on this. Well, I can't talk about it.
And real quick, I mean, because one of the things that I read, and you all know better than I've never been there. I'm not really that familiar with the company. It was just simply in the news and conversation around town and in the community, the service industry community here and beyond. You know, and they said that, and I take them at their word, that I think their general manager is a female, or two of their managers are females, and they've had females behind the bar. Just at this time, there's not. Now, that was what their statement was. I'm not backing it up because a lot of things that I heard were that was the hiring preference for males behind the bar. And certainly their ad in Singapore, that was strongly the implication. I actually saw the poster for that.
I think most of that implication, too, was actually the image that was attached to the it's not just a boys club.
Because
it was a picture of a cocktail waitress carrying a tray of drinks.
Right.
So it was kind of like, oh, no, we are open to women being here. Like, don't let us stop you. But also telling you what role you're inevitably going to have.
Right.
Which I think is the actual battle. I know that there are women who work in employees only, but their general persona is that you either kind of like put up or shut up with their very masculine behavior.
Okay.
So that might be the battle for most people.
Okay. Thank you, Katie, for that. And we have about 3 minutes before we go to the bottom of the hour break, and we'll, if we need to, continue this. But, you know, obviously we can unpack this and continue to talk about this for endlessly. I mean, it's a dialogue that, you know, needs to continue. That's what I was hoping we'd accomplish at least a bit today. What do we do? I mean,
honestly, it's like, for me, being a female behind the bar and, you know, be open to women knowing we know things. Surprise. We can run things. And we are super talented, and don't just assume just because we're behind the bar that we are idiots. I just really want everybody to stop making that assumption. That's the thing that is you have to let that gate down. Like, we're here for a reason. We're not here just because we're pretty and we're cute and all these other things. We can actually do things, and people need to stop making this assumption that we cannot be just as good or better than the boys.
Right. And on your individual merits, you are there for a reason.
Exactly.
And, you know, and I think that in all three of the establishments, and we were talking about this at the beginning of the segment in which the three of you work, you wouldn't be working and doing what you're doing if you weren't there for your individual merits, I would say.
Correct. Across the board.
Yeah. With everybody. And I think and Adrian, thank you for saying what you said there. We got about a minute and a half. Either one, you want to add something real quick? And we can come back to it if we need to.
What can we do is, to not shut up, to keep talking.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad for me to see other women in the industry afraid to be the voice. That happened with the, just small snippet, the Fernet Branca incident that happened on Facebook. I had a few friends that were like,
that was bad too.
I never could have stepped up and said something about that. I'm glad that you did, but it's all of us. Like, if all of us get together and all of us are a voice, we're not leaving anyone else out, and it removes any room for men to push back.
Right.
It doesn't work if only one person's barking. Everyone has to bark. I think it's the only way anything's going to change.
And Katie, and thank you for bringing up the Fernet Branca thing. And really quickly, just so people know, if I remember right, I also saw that poster, that ad. It was a shot from behind of a close up of a woman's bottom in tight pants. And I don't remember what the verbiage was on the wording.
The quotation was, "We have love in our hearts for bartenders, and you should too."
Yes. Okay. There we go. And a lot of people push back, and it was a mistake. Now, I guess, to a certain degree, to Fernet's credit, they immediately removed the ad. And
Scott Meyer and Ian Cox were absolutely amazing angels who responded immediately, removed the ad, and called me and outright apologized for the incident. So I do absolutely give them credit for that. Yeah, you don't want to leave that.
Yeah, and you spoke up, Katie, about that, and you were you were the person who did it. So that's fantastic. Y'all, we're going to take a bottom of the hour break here on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Come on back. If we have any last thoughts on that, on this issue, we'll come back and talk about it. Otherwise, hey, we're going to get into a little whiskey. How do we sound about that?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Come on back, folks. Everybody, welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition, WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. This is Brian Diaz here with you, cruising in the last half an hour of the show here on a Thursday. Big thanks to Sam Perry, Katie Dubois, and Adrian Miller for joining us today. And Katie, you wanted to just put a little finishing touch there on the conversation.
So basically, I think that going forward, what all of us, especially in the industry, should be focusing on is communication. Communication about how we feel, communication about our indifferences with each other and with our guests. Be able to openly talk about what it means to be a woman behind the bar and what adversities we seek. For Adrian, being able to talk about being a woman of color behind a bar, being able to for that conversation not to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think that once we open all of those channels and all of us are open with one another, that is contagious and people can't help but want to be open and part of that community as well. And I think that our biggest hindrance is sweeping everything under the rug, even if it is something that we want to talk about.
We get the dialogue True. Has to continue. And you were saying that, Adrian, before. And, you know, none of these things are going to go away overnight unless we actually talk about it and confront people with it, right? I mean, Correct. That's kind of what this is really about. So, let's take it to the lighter side, shall we? we've had a good laugh during the commercials, people. There's no blows being thrown here or anything at the straight white guy on the microphone. That's
we love you, Brian.
Thank you. We do love you, Brian.
Thank you for using your privilege and doing this.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure. And thank you for bringing alcohol in. I really appreciate that, too. It makes it really easy. Oh, yeah, we went there.
Sorry. That's all right. I mean, I appreciate that, honestly. Like, I feel like, honestly, too, if white people can be open with people of color about how they feel about us and about how we feel about them, it would be a better place. It honestly would. Like, a lot of my close friends know how I feel about a lot of racial things. And honestly, I really, especially if you get into the chance to know Ashton Barry, she has a lot of things to say about this as well. But there are points when it's just like, it's nice to have somebody, a white person, understand how you feel. It really is. And for them to get on your level and be on that uncomfortable level that, you know, being the only black person in the room or being the only Mexican person in the room or being the only woman of color or woman in a room full of people. And you're just like, I don't know what's happening right now, mm-hmm. but I'm just going to smile and nod and pretend like everything's okay.
Right. Well, great. Thank you, Adrian, for adding that to everything.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. I'm Brian Diaz here with you, and we are enjoying our final day, as you know, at Runaway Boucherie. And I'm pleased to be joined by one of the gentlemen behind the event here today, Toby Rodriguez. Toby, how are you?
I'm good. A little bit tired, but we're holding it together.
Awesome, man. Thank you for... So this is your place that we're enjoying this great event at.
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for hosting, man.
Oh, no problem. It's my pleasure.
So this is a beautiful space. We'll have some pictures up a little bit later on our Facebook page and website and all that. But how long have you lived out here, man?
I actually recently moved out here a few months ago. But I've had some friends that have lived on the property that actually owned the property that hosted us in the past, and the event went so well, and I had such a good time out here, I figured I should just move on the property.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it makes sense. Convenient.
Yeah.
So now, have you been involved? This is the third year of the event. Have you been involved since the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Tell us a little bit about the organization and the event, sort of how it came to be and how you all got together.
Well, I've been doing what I do, which is teaching traditional boucheries, I guess, for about 8 years now. And About 4 years ago, I met Katie and Denny Culbert, who have Runaway Dish, which is a nonprofit pop-up, you know, dinner group that puts on like local pop-ups. They pair two chefs together and have a meal, and the proceeds of the meal, the ticket sales go to a local nonprofit. Great. And pairing up with them seeing what I was doing, meeting with them, and them having like a really connection to the culinary community, they pretty much introduced me to every local chef that I know now, in Lafayette and in New Orleans, and that kind of changed the game of things. You know, like the boucheries took on a different form. It became more about, instead of just preserving tradition, we were preserving foodways. You know, I feel like consciously delving a bit deeper into what the boucherie is and like why it's necessary and how it's relevant today, and that I guess that that relation developed into this weekend, which is Runaway Boucherie.
Can you do me a favor, Toby, actually, for listeners, especially a lot of people that aren't from the area, can you define or explain the term boucherie?
Boucherie is a French word that means butchering. In South Louisiana, in Acadiana, the Cajuns normally associate a boucherie with the killing of a pig. Traditionally, multiple family members or multiple families or neighbors and friends came together for a butchering. A farmer had a pig and called all his friends and family and his neighbors to come over and give him a hand. And, of course, that harvest turns into a party, and everyone eats and goes home with like a little bit of the meat that was processed there, and everyone gets a little bit. I feel like it's Acadiana, South Louisiana has, you know, like in a lot of ways, like we are normally seen as being last on the list when it's something good and first on the list when it's something bad. But as far as like, you know, progressive, like what people would refer to as like eating progressively, you know, whether it's farm to table or eating organically, like we like never really had a farm to table movement because we never really lost it. So this is like in one sense where we're actually kind of ahead of the ball game here. You know, like the boucherie is a perfect example of that. Like, it's not something, we're like one of the only cultures that hasn't lost its butchering tradition. Like, we still, like here in America, we still have a tradition of butchering, where within most cultures in this country, that tradition has been lost because of industrialization.
Mm-hmm. So how did you personally, is a family trade, or
my father farmed sugar cane as a kid, and we had, you know, we grew up on a farm, we had animals, and because we birthed and raised those animals, we felt it only natural to also slaughter and process them too. So I grew up on a farm that butchered its own animals and held those traditions.
And that's really important. I think one of the things that that you've demonstrated here this weekend that was really fascinating to watch were the butchering demonstrations and slaughter that you put on. And as we were talking earlier with Gary, it connects us to the meal, I think, in a way that's very important that people need to really understand and see.
You know, there's a lot of talk about what's missing in our diets. It's always some nutrient or like something that's, you know, at one point was good and now is demonized. But the thing that like no one's really talking about, like what's truly missing in our diets in this country, is emotion. Without emotion, there's no grief, there's no remorse, there's no regret, there's no respect. You know, like it's hard to for us to be sustainable in our diets and not waste without knowing the source.
Right.
Like people need to be connected to their food source. Like a community should have an emotional connection to their food source, because, you know, it makes it a whole lot more difficult to pull in that drive-through.
Absolutely. meat doesn't come in a styrofoam tin wrapped in plastic.
Exactly.
Tray.
Exactly.
Well, and I noticed, Toby, when with some of the slaughter demonstrations, I think as you're saying, it was a very solemn and very dignified process. I found it to be very solemn, actually, and people stood there quietly and reverentially, I think, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. We live in a society that's a bit desensitized. You know, everything has to feel good, you know, and if it doesn't feel good, then there's an app for that, you know, or, you know, I think that, like, you know, in seeing a butchering and seeing a slaughtering, seeing the harvest, the kill of the animal, it's a complete necessity. Like, I feel like that's something that should be seen by anyone who consumes meat. You know, it truly connects you to the source. I mean, it's not something that, like, I enjoy doing. It's not something that I wake up in the morning and want to do. But it's not all, you know, I mean, it's a responsibility. It's not about, like, it's not always about, like, what you want to do what you're going to enjoy, or what's going to bring you pleasure. It's about our responsibility. And to think that, like, our species is designed with all the tools to feed ourselves, that we're meant to kill, to harvest animals. Like, we've got canines, you know, it's undeniable. Like, it's part of our physical design, and that most human beings have no idea how to do that.
And what it
how
means,
to how
what?
To like how to truly feed themselves, how to harvest their own food,
right?
Whether you're a vegetarian or a meat lover.
That's right. Now, Toby, you also have a butcher shop in town, don't you?
I am the manager of the Fresh Market near Crawfishtown, USA, in Henderson, Louisiana.
In Henderson, okay, yeah. Great, excellent. And so, can you tell people how to connect with this event, or is it Runaway Dish? Is that the best place to go about it?
I can't do that because it's invite only.
Yeah, maybe more support. Kind of what I'm getting at is not necessarily plan to come to the event because it is invite only, but to support the organization and the movement.
You know, I would say the best way to support this organization, or the movement, or like our mission, is to please purchase food from your local farmer. That's number one.
That's the best.
Like,
thing,
to support what we're doing, like, you know, think twice about going to the big chain store. Think twice about, like, buying boxed meat at your local supermarket. Try to find the local food. Try to, like, connect directly with your farmer. That's the best way.
That's great, Toby. I appreciate that. Toby, thanks so much for taking time, man.
No problem.
Thanks so much for hosting this wonderful event. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Folks, thank you. Toby Rodriguez out here at Runaway Boucherie, and it's been a great weekend. Really appreciate it. Come on back to the show. This is Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drink Show, WGSO 990 AM here in New Orleans.
Everybody, welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. This is your host, Brian Diaz, WGSO 990 AM, New Orleans. Uber has been conquered, apparently. Braden Legrone has now joined us here timely during the break. Braden, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So how did it go? It sounds like I was getting with these Facebook messages here about where you were and the technical difficulties you experienced with the Uber driver.
I guess you could say it was a very cranky old man such as myself versus a very stubborn old man, which is my driver, kept insisting, oh, no, it's on Carondelet. I'll go on Carondelet. I said, no, we're, you know, near Cure on Brett Street. Like, you don't want to do that. There's school traffic. There's this thing. He was like, no, don't worry. The GPS is rerouting them every 3 seconds.
Oh, no.
I had to get out of the car and tell a cop, let us just get through. you know, like, I'm late for the radio. I don't know if you believe me or not, but I don't think he's ever heard that excuse before.
And so it worked then?
It did work, yes.
Okay, great. Radio's
apparently... I hope you did it in your best old-timey voice.
I'm going to be on the radio.
Good thing you didn't tell him it was this show, because he probably would just would have put you in the podunk, man.
Right.
Well, thanks for joining us, Braden. And now we're, of course, here we're chatting with Nick Dietrich before, and... Well, let's do this, you guys. What I want to do, we're talking about this at the top of the show, out of the gate, and we're going to do a segment here called What's in Your Glass, What's in Your Bottle, and as I mentioned, that's where we talk about social issues, economic issues, environmental issues, cultural issues connected to the drink and food world, and in this case, these two gentlemen, Nick and Braden, are very active, knowledgeable, and supportive of the agave producers in Mexico. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. Braden, and just to kick this off with you, you're moving to Mexico, man, aren't you, pretty soon?
Yep, just after Thanksgiving.
Okay, great. And what do you got going on there? I mean, what's bringing you down?
Well, I mean, a few things are bringing me down there. I've always wanted to live in Mexico ever since I first went there when I was around the age of like 13. Mm-hmm. I've just always wanted to be there. And I never wanted to, only live in America. I always wanted to have that experience outside of the country. I got me a señorita. So that's the main reason, and most everything else is just pretty trivial. But
that's a good answer if she's listening. We'll listen to the podcast later.
Or we'll listen to it later. Yes.
you've acquitted yourself nicely there, Brent.
Yes,
welcome.
Yes, thank you. So I can get that part out of the way. So there's a cocktail bar there called Pigal, pretty popular there in Guadalajara, that I'm going to be kind of managing and helping to run. And then I'm just going to keep my options open as far as that. I have a close friendship with David Suro and Pedro Menez from Tequila Interchange Project, Siembra Spirits, and Pedro Menez from Masante. So hopefully I can make something work out with them when we get down there and, see where I'm needed, see what's there. But the distillery that David Suro works with just north of Guadalajara in Arenal called Cascoin, they've invited me to go there and I can work with them. Not for money, but, for the experience mm-hmm. to do it. And so I really look forward to doing that.
Well, you've spent a lot of time recently going to Mexico, and you have familiarized yourself with the issues surrounding agave production and mm-hmm. the products. In this case, mezcal we're talking about, and of course, tequila also. And then the cultural and political import, economic import, and all of that. And you have become a big advocate for this, I guess is a good way to put it.
Right. Actually, I think the last time I was on your show, I was getting ready to go on a rather large trip. Starting in Guadalajara, then going to Mexico City, then back to Guadalajara, then Oaxaca. And the part of Mexico City was I went with David Suro to a forum held by, biological academia and just connoisseurs of mezcal themselves, such as Pedro Menez, on the issue of NAM 199.
And tell us a little bit about that. Go ahead and elaborate on that.
I mean, NAM 199 is, in a nutshell... a federal rule to regulate the name of agave, tequila, mezcal's production. And, it's the same appellation of origins and DOs that you see for champagne, cognac, and bourbon and all that. The government sets these rules saying how you can make it, what you can call it, where you can sell it, and, yada, yada, yada. And it was just another rule that was supposed to update the old one. And people such as myself and the majority of people at the conference on 199 felt as though it was... ill-ridden, that it kind of favored a large industrial side producers as opposed to the smaller, more agricultural, historical producers, say, like, especially in Jalisco, where Jalisco is not a part of the Appalachian of origin or an area for
mezcal. Yep.
And so 199 basically stripped them of the right to call what they do mezcal, mm-hmm. even though in Jalisco they've been making mezcal as long as anywhere else in the country. And there's actually evidence to argue maybe even longer. That it might even come from Jalisco. But Jalisco is definitely known more for tequila.
Right.
And ricea.
Now, so there was a term, and Nick can jump in anywhere on this too. There was a term that I think was being bandied about being applied to mezcal and some of the others in that family of stuff. And I'd like you guys to talk about that too a little bit. And it was just basically a really obscure regional dialect term for alcohol, right? And they were going to mm-hmm. force producers to put that on the label.
Comil.
Comil.
K-O-M-I-L.
Okay. And so then has that gone through? Where is this process right now?
The last that I've heard is that the debates are closed. All petitions have been filed and considered, and that it's just been tabled. The Secretary of Economy has officially just tabled it for now.
Okay.
One theory is that maybe when the heat dies down a little bit more for some of like the larger companies who are pushing for this law, you know, maybe they'll release their findings at that point in time, or maybe it's just been tabled indefinitely. You know, I think it comes as no surprise to any American listeners that the Mexican government sometimes isn't forthright.
Yes.
And they kind of just do things the way they want to. And they have a little bit, they answer to a little bit more than just the will of the people. You know, but that's almost any government. So.
Yeah, I don't think there's too many exceptions to that.
Yeah. I mean, Sweden maybe, but I don't know.
Right. Well, that's a topic for another show. We'll do Swedish Punch or something like that. Right. And the social issues connected to that. But so in this case, and Nick, I know you're a big supporter of this process as well. For Canaan Table is kind of known as a proto-tiki and kind of more of a rum-themed bar, I guess. But you guys serve mezcal, and you've been behind this for a while.
Well, I mean, rum is very important to our program, but what we – with the proto-tiki sort of ideals, it looks at all of the sort of spirits that helped to shape North America. You know, Mexico occupying a large part of that in both spirits – well, literal spirits and then also geography. It's something that is very important to Canaan Table's program.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And so now, Nick, have you been down to that part of the world too? Where in agave production?
I have not been to Jalisco, but I've been to all around Oaxaca and outside Mexico City.
So you've had a chance to connect with some of these people and some of the people that are making local distillates.
Yeah, it's funny. The bottle that Braden brought is from the same company, and they work with three different distillers now. One is we brought in the boat both is from the same company, so. Okay. High five.
And it's nice. I like that. Good move. So it's a Mezcal Vago we're talking about here. Always got to describe these things. We're on the radio. I had a guy that was on last week that wanted to do show and tell with a brochure. And I'm like, I think this is far more effective for TV.
So did he just read the brochure?
He said, I have something I want to show you. Got off the microphone.
Pulled
the brochure. Yeah. And I said, I started describing the picture, Braden, which is never a good idea. And so let's maybe move along. We'll put that on the... somewhere online, somewhere later. Well, so with you guys, let's talk a little bit about this. We've got a couple minutes before we take a break. Can you guys, thank you. They're passing me some of the, we're describing here again, mezcal. You guys are passing me mezcal in the traditional copitas. And maybe give us a description of that. And let's talk, and I want to come back with this after the break too, but let's talk about the copitas a little bit and how it's traditionally served this way.
So it's this is traditionally served. You know, it's basically more found in Oaxaca. There are some archaeological sites where you find these kind of like clay cups like this in sites in Jalisco as well. But it's definitely much more popular to have that in Oaxaca, and which is why I brought it with the Oaxacan mezcal. And again, from what Nick was saying, it's a mezcal vago based out of Oaxaca, and. It's a company that I have a lot of respect for. They care very much about the biological and cultural diversity, and you know, they care very much about the process of it and the people involved into it. It's very much a celebration of the culture itself, as opposed to trying to change or reformulate it. In specific, this is the Vago Quixe. Quixe agave, part of the Cahuenské family of agaves, is my favorite. It has a very distinct chocolate and rich dirt smoke to it that all of them have. And I think the Vago Quixe does a really good job of kind of showcasing that. And the agaves themselves aren't these big, bulbous, round piñas that you kind of like see when you were like Google an image of a piña or think about one in your head. It's literally a little bit more like skinny and long. And so it takes a little bit more time to roast. It takes a little bit more time to mash. And the output in terms of the raw materials and juices that you get out of it aren't really going to be as rich and plentiful as other agaves.
Okay.
So it is a little bit more of a labor of love.
And you guys educated me on this, or have educated me on this in the past, that there is not just one species of agave that's used. Well, there's a huge number of agave species, correct? And then there's a smaller subset, but it is more than one that's used to make mezcal and tequila, correct?
So think about like tequila and the very specific kind of mezcal.
Okay.
Mezcal can be made with many, many, many different kinds of agave. Tequila is made with one agave. That's the Blue Weber agave.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, you know, and so like the next one we'll try that Nick brought is one of their Ensemble Barrels, which is, you know, this one that he has is going to be a blend of three different agaves.
Okay.
As opposed to the one we're drinking right now, which is just Quixote.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've heard different numbers on like how many they use for mezcal. Yeah, it's 42 to 46, usually sometimes way outside that number, though, too.
Yeah, I think one website I was reading said over 200. I'm like, no, well, that's not true. But.
Wow. Okay.
So I like to say the phrase many, many.
Many, many. Yeah. Not just many, many, many. And that, right. That puts us in the
that's
ballpark.
My political answer.
Very good. Well done. Well done. Very exacting in a political sense. You guys, we're going to take a quick break here on the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit more into the cultural component of this, talk a little bit more about production, and I want to get into a little bit more of what this means to our listeners to care about this stuff. So come on back.
You went away, you left me long time ago. Now you come back knocking on my door. Are you, you know?
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition here on WGSO 990 AM New Orleans. This is your host, Brian Diaz. Thanks for tuning in today. We are doing our segment, What's in Your Glass, What's in Your Bottle? And we are chatting a little bit about agave production in Mexico with Nick Dietrich and Brayden Legrone. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in today. You guys have brought a couple beautiful Mezcal Vago, and we were talking a bit about how this company is socially responsible with the production methods, who they work with, how they go about it. So let's talk a little bit about production. We touched on in the last segment, many, many, to quote Brayden, species of agave within the larger family, maybe 40 something or so that are used to produce mezcal. And as Brayden educated us on, it's the blue agave that's used to produce tequila. Now there are other things like espadine, for example, in the family of agave distillates. Are there, so there's a few that have names, right? And then I'm imagining there's some regional variation that are just kind of no name stuff. Is that true? Or
I mean, yes, to a degree. Certainly. I mean, and you mentioned espadine, and espadine's what, 80 something percent of all mezcals are made with espadine and come from Oaxaca.
Okay.
But honestly, you would think, because like they do call a palenque, a factoria, like they call like the site where you distill different things in different states, whether it's Michoacán or Jalisco or Oaxaca, but or anywhere else that you're going to be distilling mezcal. But honestly, the names of the agaves, I haven't seen a lot of variance in.
Okay.
It's pretty consistent no matter where you are in the country. When they point to that, they say Barriel or Quixote.
Okay.
There are some, like, especially like, so one of the bottles that we brought is from Sola de Vega, where they actually call this has Barril in it, and they call it something else, which I can't remember, but Judah and Dylan were like, no one's going to know what you're talking about if we put that on the bottle, so it's Barril.
Oh. There we go. Makes
but
sense.
That's the only instance I've heard of that, too.
Right.
Okay, interesting. So now, if the stuff is not produced then in the appellation, but there's a lot of stuff that's made from agave that's not produced within the mezcal or tequila appellations, correct?
That's right.
And so then that stuff will have then regional names?
For the most part, yes. They'll have some regional names, such as Bacanora is produced mainly, again, with espadine agaves. It is roasted underground and just distilled twice and hardly ever cut with really any water, you know, maybe Punta Tecalas. But, you know, so it's very much like mezcal in Oaxaca, but it's produced in the northern state of Sonora. Or you go to Chihuahua, and they have a plant that's very similar to agave, but isn't agave, but we're going to consider it agave for the time being, called Sotal. And then, yeah, if you're in western Jalisco, in the western mountain ranges around there, they produce what's known as ricea. And the story goes there that it was kind of like an avoidance of the tax man. He would come around and want you to pay taxes on your mezcal. You say, oh, no, but we don't make mezcal here. We make ricea.
Ricea. Uh-huh. Very good. I like that story. Interesting. So now let's talk a little bit, you guys, about the general process of production with agave. This is another thing that I find very fascinating, that this is not something – there's time required for the agave to mature before it is then put into production, correct?
Yeah, I think we actually got really lucky and brought two great examples of two very different sort of like production styles and techniques. But I mean, generally with agave, the espadine, the reason you see so much of it is because it's one of the takes one of the shortest amount of time to mature. I mean, I've heard anything from 5 years to sometimes up to 12, but that's pretty old for an espadine.
Right, right. So it's very functional in terms of like that. It's just like the Blue Weber agave. I think it has almost the same growing time, around 5 to 8 years, or anywhere as high as 12. But again, you know, kind of depends on the humidor, really, the person who's going through the field. And then it depends on, you know, how they want to cut it. And there's just, you know, there's so much of a human element to it that is very agricultural, that it's really, you know, it's just kind of up to whoever's making it in that time.
And that's an important issue. And I think that's a nice segue, Braden, is that we want to talk about today here. Also, what we want to touch on is, you go from a particular village, particular producer that's doing this stuff. It is a cult. It is a way of life. It is embedded in the culture. I know stories that you guys have shared with me times past of, in some of these cases, this stuff is produced at the village level and it is all consumed, say, through family reunions and birthday parties. Mm-hmm. This is not just sort of something that's sold as a product per se to just send to the United States and sell away. There is a significant cultural importance to this stuff and in a way of life, as I said.
I mean, very much so. And that's why I think Bago is an amazing company to celebrate amongst many others. But I think it's just kind of funny that Nick and I both brought that should tell you something, that he and I are both like, okay, we're going to go on the radio and talk about agave. What bottle I want to bring? Bago.
Bago.
Well, plus, I also wanted to bring something that you can get in America.
That you are able to get
that's
here.
Right. That's okay. Right. Not all the expressions everywhere throughout the country, but you can always go down to Kiva Company and pick up a bottle of the Espadine, and it's delicious.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. that's one great thing about this company too, is that they you know, it's all family run, and they, because all of the family members are the ones who are working it, they're able to make a lot more interesting decisions about some of the stuff that they pick out. So for instance, they'll do very small runs, and this is going to what Braden was saying, that you know, you can get this in the US, but it varies from state to state or market to market what you can get, because sometimes they'll just make something that's such a small batch that it's only going to go one place. Like a couple years ago, they did something called a bien picado, which means basically just like real bit up in Spanish. I mean, kind of. Which is basically whenever an agave plant will sprout a stamen to basically pollinate, but you'll want to hack that off, and that's when the agave plant will actually start to produce sugars and things like that. Okay. But you're effectively like kind of killing the plant, and so it starts to die, and there's like a certain percentage of like basically agave plants that are really eaten up and rotting and very fermented by the time they hit distillation. So what they decided to do was they just took a batch of over, like they said, it was like usually around 15-20% of the batch will be rotten, but this one was 70%. And so they decided that they were going to do a very small run of that. So they just did like 180 liters and just released it only in Houston, in Texas. And they just have a lot of freedom to do a lot of very interesting stuff.
That's really fascinating. And so it's almost kind of reminds me of, say, like in the wine world, we're talking about botrytis and mm-hmm. things like that, which is that's fascinating. So what, in that case, with that stuff, with the semi-rotted, or I like how they put a number on it, 70% rotten. That's like a, there's got to be a scale on the label somewhere. What kind of effect does that have on the flavor profile?
I mean, it made it a lot sweeter. It was like really surprisingly like rich and sweet. But I mean, one thing that happens, and this is something that happens with all mezcal, is the way that it's rested and like both after it's harvested and after it's fermented, or after it's roasted and before it's fermented, there is a lot of indigenous yeast that gets in there. And so the longer, like, depending on where it is, you'll pick up different tropical notes, but basically there's a lot of variety in yeast, and so a lot of massive variations in flavor, even from espadine to espadine, from village to village.
Interesting. Fascinating. Nick, Braden, you guys can stick around a little bit longer here, right? I hope so. Okay, excellent. We are talking about mezcal, agave, all kinds of wonderful stuff here with Nick Dietrich and Braden Legrone. What's in your glass? What's in your bottle? Folks, come on back to hour number two of the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition, WGSO 990 AM. We'll be right back after the top of the hour.
on a bottle of whiskey. Oh, I feel all right. Feel all right. I feel all right. Feel all right.
This is Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to hour number two of the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition, WGSO 990 AM. Happy to be here with y'all. I am chatting with Nick Dietrich and Braden Legrone from the Cure fam. What should I call you guys? Is it the Cure family of establishments? Cure, Cane and Table,
Cure,
Cafe
Cure
Henry?
Co. has been the one that Neil likes the most.
That would probably make sense, but he's not here. So, what do you guys prefer to be called?
Cure family. Family. That anything works.
I mean, or you could refer to us as my favorite band, The Cure.
The Cure, right? Yeah. Exactly. Okay, that very Robert Smith of you. Great. Well, you guys were talking a little bit here during this segment about mezcal, and this is our segment: What's in Your Glass, What's in Your Bottle, and we're talking about traditional production. Methods, some of the cultural import of this, some of the threats to this. And I kind of want to bring that back around to circle back on a couple things. But before I do, Nick, can you tell us a little bit more? Would you elaborate on the one that you just poured for us? I know we touched on it, but we didn't get too far into it.
Yeah. So, basically, up until recently, Mezcal Vago used only two producers, and, it was, Aquilino, Garcia Lopez, who works out of Candelaria Yagole. And a little bit west of that is another village, called Sola de Vega, which is a, cousin through marriage, of Aquilino and Judah, who is the son-in-law of Aquilino. So it's, you know, it's a pretty tight-knit group. but, this one here is interesting just because it is, what Aquilino does in Candelaria Yagole, the first one we tasted, is, it's a little bit more modern than what Tio Rey does.
From a production process standpoint?
Right. So what he uses an olla de barro, which is a clay pot still, which is more closely modeled after the Filipino style of still, which they believe came to Oaxaca in the 9th century AD. So, So well before, you had, the Columbia Exchange and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
He also grinds everything by hand. So he basically, they'll be out there with two axes just hacking up and crushing agave that way, as opposed to using a tahona, which is the large stone wheel typically pulled by a donkey. Or some beast of burden, sometimes an ox, he also has a 100-year-old tree, dug out, like, kind of like a canoe, that he uses for, most of his fermentation.
Oh, wow. Like an open air kind of thing?
Okay. Yeah. Which is another, I'm talking a little bit about yeast before the break, which is another interesting aspect of it, because, with these open air fermentations there, the indigenous yeast will pick up a lot of notes and characteristics from what you have growing around it. And throughout Oaxaca, you have a great diversity of microclimates. And so you'll have very, very differing tastes from village to village. So, like, if you just go over a set of mountains, you'll have a completely different read on the Espadine there as you would on the other side. Mm-hmm. And also with the open air, you have both aerobic and anaerobic fermentation happening. So you have the yeast that's settling at the bottom of the tank, that's in a environment that's not afflicted by air.
No oxygen. Yeah.
Right. And so they're able to eat a little bit more robustly, mm-hmm. and produce, like, heavier esters and alcohols. And then you have the indigenous yeast at the top, who's also consuming it, and they're producing some of the, like, lighter fruit and floral notes.
Interesting.
The one great thing also about Vago is the way that they print their labels is you have, from top to bottom, everything that you could possibly want to ask about it, like what kind of agave you have, who the producer is, where it's from, the still, how large the batch was, when it was made, and everything like that. And so this one is a blend. And one interesting thing about the way that they do this traditionally in Mexico is it's not blended post-distillation, but they actually harvest, for roast, ferment, and do everything together.
Oh, okay.
So
like a co-fermented wine with two varietals that we're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
And so that way, you know, like in a lot of whiskeys and scotches and things like that, or even rums, mm-hmm. where you have a lot of blends, those are all done post-distillation and oftentimes post-aging as well.
Okay.
Here, it's start to finish. And so from an actual physics point of view, it lowers the state of entropy, which basically means you have like a better rested spirit from at the end, even though it's a white spirit or an unaged spirit.
Interesting. That's fascinating. You guys, and what I want to bring this to now, while we have four or five minutes before the break, we talk about the cultural import of this and things like that, and I'd like to, since we're obviously a New Orleans-based food and drink show, or drink and food show, as I like to say these days, emphasis on drink. We eat sometimes. Let's talk a little bit about why this is. I want to make the listeners aware of why these issues with mezcal and agave production should be important here. There are different brands out there. There's different things to be considered, and we don't have to throw anybody under the bus. But we're highlighting Vago, for example. I think another brand that you mentioned, Del Maguey, right? That are paying attention to where their production channels come from and who they're dealing with. Feel free to elaborate on that. I think it's important. I want to know when people actually go out, mezcal has enjoyed a great uptick in the marketplace in this country. New Orleans is certainly no exception to that. And, I think, you know, we want people to be knowledgeable when they go out and buy these things.
I mean, yeah, very much so. I mean, when you look at the history of agave in America, you can't ignore what happened in the mid and early 90s with tequila. And there was such a rush and such a push by very large industrial players just to get tequila to the American market that the ideas of, you know, conservation and the agricultural elements of it were kind of just thrown to the wayside. And it was treated very industrially. You had people smuggling in illegal agaves from other countries. You had them come in from other states, which is against all, you know, the basic regulations that we now follow. But yeah, I mean, there's many companies whose main goal now is, you know, it is to preserve what's there. It mm-hmm. is to be able to show to us what we can have, because there are some hardliners in Mexico. I mean, what I saw when I was there in 199 is I was used an example of why is there a gringo here? Why are we even selling mezcal to the Americans? Because some of these companies are going in there and having such a detrimental effect that we're kind of caught under this umbrella. They don't really understand that, you know, yes, there are the white people who come in and they buy the companies, you know, so say like, you know, some people locally will start up a company and then some large multi-million dollar brand such as Bacardi or Diageo or Pernod Ricard comes in and buys the company, and they don't have such a stake in the, you know, in the preservation of those people and of that land. And so I think that there's a slight bit of a view by some hardliners down there of, you know, kind of the appropriation of this. But that's not the majority of people at all, honestly. And that's why I love David Suro from Tequila Interchange Project and Siembra Spirits, who brings in Siembra Azul and Siembra Bias into here in New Orleans. But soon we'll be getting Siembra Mattel and the Don Mateo, which are two mezcal expressions from Michoacan and done by the same producer. He has a huge stake invested in the preservation of this and showing it at the same time to Americans as to see what these mezcals can do and tequilas can do. And so I'm a big fan of his work, especially in just trying to educate the American market on, yeah, you're going to pay a little bit more for a bottle.
Right.
It's pretty much what it comes down to. We have, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to piggyback off of that too. You know, one other thing that we need to consider as well as the cultural and heritage is just the entire exchange that we have had in New Orleans with our cuisine and the Native American cultures here. There's still so much of that that's present. You know, we wouldn't have fia for gumbo if it weren't for that sort of like exchange. And we basically had a big exchange like that happened in Mexico. It's the same thing happening. A Native culture and a non-Native culture colliding and producing something that becomes integral to that region and also really tells a great deal of history about that area, the same way that you can talk about, you know, 600 years of history with a bowl of gumbo. You can do the same thing with a bottle of mezcal.
That's a great point, you guys. And did you want to add something, Braden?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, it's about you know, when you enjoy it, you're enjoying the history and the experience of it. And I've often said that mezcal and agave should be treated more like an experience rather than it is a product. And because very much just like with gumbo, it's rich in history and tradition, and it's something to be celebrated. And I think that's the best way to enjoy it.
And that's well stated again, you guys. And I think that something here, and of course, in this part of the world, we certainly appreciate, and you just mentioned that, Nick, that this is something, and I appreciate what you guys just said, because this is something that should resonate with everyone out there listening because of the importance of food and drink being woven into the culture here in New Orleans. This is another good example of that, and being aware of what it is that you're purchasing with agave products, and, you know, in this case, mezcal, what we're talking about primarily here today, I think is really important. And yes, as you said, Braden, you're probably going to pay a little bit more money, but it's worth it, because when we consider that, the cultural importance, the quality of the product, I think there's a dollar to performance ratio there that matters. It's not you're paying more just to pay more to be a good guy. You're paying more to get something that's better.
I mean, exactly. I mean, yeah, some of these mezcals are priced, and I think very appropriately for what they are. You know, I mean, and again, I just want to reiterate, the best way to experience all this is to go there.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to go to Oaxaca or Jalisco or Michoacan to enjoy mezcal, but it certainly helps.
That's nice. And let's build a little tourism, you know, promote some tourism down there.
Come stay at my place.
come stay at your place when you go down there, Braden. Well, can you guys do me a favor and stick around for one more segment? I want to talk a little bit about some at the bar stuff, and we will come back around, and we'll share some of this stuff on the Facebook page. I'll get more information from you guys about some of these producers and things we've tasted, so people can see that on the NOLA Drinks Facebook page. Come on back to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition, WGSO 990 AM, New Orleans.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you really enjoyed the show here. Check us out at NOLADrinks.com. Check us out on social media, NOLA Drinks. Look for more information. We'll be back with a brand new show next week, Thursday, 3 p.m. in New Orleans on 990 AM New Orleans Radio, Talk Radio, WGSO, 990 AM. Folks, have a great holiday weekend, or if you're listening to it after, I hope you had a great holiday weekend. And until then, cheers, y'all.